This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Over the course of the almost completed NBA regular season, 9 teams have replaced head coaches. In a recent article for the Boston Globe, Peter May examined the strategy of changing coaches. May, and everybody else who watches the NBA, has been thoroughly impressed by how well the process has worked for the Denver Nuggets.
We've seen something that I don't think we're ever going to see again with George Karl in Denver. As we talk today, he is undefeated since the All-Star break, which was 2 months ago, against any team that doesn't reside in Arizona. This is an extraordinary, extraordinary thing that he did.
Joining me now from New York is Mitch Lawrence, the NBA columnist for the Daily News. Mitch, it may be an understatement to say that replacing the coach hasn't worked as well for the Knicks as it has for the Nuggets.
No, it has. The Knicks have changed coaches several times over the last few years, but they haven't had any success, and they need to change owners. I think a lot of us down here feel in New York.
Lenny Wilkins, of course, was the departing coach. He was 17-22. Any hope that with more time, the current guy turns things around?
Well, we all like Herb Williams. He's very popular. He's obviously popular not only with the media, but the Garden people, Garden fans, because he's a Knicks favorite. He played here part of his career when the Knicks were good back in the 90s. But, you know, Herb is still a neophyte, and I don't really, you know if he, at this point, has shown that he can be a head coach in the league as much as, you know, everybody wants him to succeed. And so I think, you know, they might have to go outside to bring in someone with more experience who can get the team to play, you know, certainly improve in the defensive area and things like that.
The Knicks have by far the biggest payroll in the National Basketball Association, over $100 million. Why hasn't this translated into better play and more wins?
Well, you know, there's really no direct correlation between a high payroll and success in the league. Unfortunately, the Knicks, over the last few years, tend to overpay players. They've got a lot of bad contracts on their hands. They tend to pay players way above what their talent is. I mean, you know, Allen Houston, who's hardly played this year because of a knee injury, he was re-signed a few years ago for $100 million. Stephon Marbury's making, you know, $14, $15 million this year, and he's been the key to Isaiah Thomas's rebuilding program, but he hasn't really proven that he's a winner or a leader. And you have players like Penny Hardaway, who's been out for a long time with a hamstring injury, basically packed it in a long time ago, making $14, $15 million. And Tim Thomas, a reserve forward, makes $13, $14 million. Those four players there together are making $60 million, around $60 million. And that's more than the salary cap of the league. Every team is supposed to be at $45 million. Right. We know that they exceed that. But, you know, in the Knicks' case, you know, right now they're at $102 million, and they're going up to $110 million already. They're committed to those types of salaries for next year.
For decades, the Knicks were the darlings of New York, and the New Jersey Nets were the laughingstock. But things are so bad for the Knicks now, they become a punchline. Nets guard Jason Kidd said recently that beating the Knicks was just like beating any other bad team.
Right, they're just another bad team. And, he's true. I mean, the Nets have been the better team, obviously, for the last several years since Jason Kidd came here. I mean, they went to the NBA Finals twice during that period. They took Detroit to a seventh game last year, which is more than the Lakers did, and the Nets had a great chance to win that series. So it's not surprising now that the Nets are on top here and the Knicks are the second team.
If the Knicks continue to spiral downward, could the Nets assume the title of the number one team in the hearts and minds of New Yorkers by the time the team moves to Brooklyn in a few years, or do the Knicks forever have a claim on the Big Apple?
I think if it's up to Bruce Ratner, who just bought the Nets and wants to move them to Brooklyn, he would love that if they could surpass the Knicks. I don't know. I mean, I have my doubts about them moving to Brooklyn, which is, you know, has been and will always be, in my mind, Knicks country. But, you know, it depends. I mean, you know, they're going to move to Brooklyn, let's say, in 2008. You know, nobody really has an idea of who would be on that Nets team now. The kid would certainly probably not be there. As a matter of fact, he had a great line when, you know, it was first announced they were moving to Brooklyn. He said to the effect of, well, they might be moving to Brooklyn, but I'm not.
That must have been encouraging for managers and owners.
Well, it's not atypical. Jason Kidd always he likes to skewer management whenever he can, which is weird because that's a situation where they've taken care of him. They've done everything that he's wanted them to do in terms of player acquisitions and moves, just about every move anyway. I don't really know if the Nets can surpass the Knicks. Unless, you know, they go into Brooklyn with a championships-type team, a team that can win the title and have, you know, many, many years of success there because, after all, Brooklyn is still a Knicks address.
One advantage to playing badly for a while is draft picks, and the Knicks have two first-round picks in this year's draft and two more first-rounders next year. Can this be turned around with some shrewd picks by Isaiah Thomas?
Well, it can be helped. The thing is, in the NBA, if you're going to be bad, you want to be real bad. So the argument can be made, and I've made it in some columns already, that the Knicks have won too many games already this year. 30 wins is way too many. If you're going to be bad, do it like Atlanta and win 12. And that way you get the number one or the number two overall pick. But, you know, two picks can hurt. The thing is that Isaiah Thomas has to do a much better job drafting than he's done trade-wise, because so far none of his trades have worked out. The only thing he's done with these deals that he's made is to bring on more salaries, which is really not the object here. He should be trying to reduce payroll. But that gets back to, you know, the owner doesn't here want to rebuild. That's the thing. There needs to really be a change of philosophy, change in direction of where this team is going, because as long as they're willing to add payroll, you can argue they're never going to get that franchise talent that they had in Patrick Ewing and turn this thing around.
Mitch Lawrence is the NBA columnist for the New York Daily News. Mitch, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Okay, anytime.
Olympic success is often followed by professional exhibition tours and talk show appearances. The luckiest and most photogenic medalists can get enormous endorsement deals and Hollywood contracts. But reporter Greg Eklin recently spent some time with a recent Olympian who's taking a different route.
Pounds. Can I get them together?
You sure can. I got 5 pounds to go, and I got another 5 pounds over here.
The Tuscaloosa Crawfish Festival is a staple of local culture, along with Crimson Tide baseball and, of course, football. Another slightly lesser known but successful Tuscaloosa tradition is University of Alabama Women's Gymnastics, which now features Taryn Humphrey, a country girl from Bates City, Missouri. The 18-year-old Humphrey, a two-time silver medalist in Athens last August, is the only member of last year's U.S. team now in college as a freshman. But her decision to compete in college wasn't made until after the Olympics, according to Sarah Patterson, the Crimson Tide's women's gymnastics coach.
My only concern about her not enrolling was immediately after the Olympics, when nobody knew exactly how much sponsorship money these ladies could be given or offered. And I had been to Kansas City or to Bates City prior to her leaving for training camp for the Olympics, and I shared with her parents what the cost of her five-year education would be.
Humphrey toured in the fall with the national team on the TJ Maxx Tour of Champions. She arrived in Tuscaloosa the day after Christmas, apprehensive, according to Patterson, about embarking yet again on a rigorous training schedule.
I just told her we were going to take our time, and I think sometimes she still pinches herself and isn't really sure, you know, exactly what's going to happen. But she knows that she's surrounded by people who love her, care about her, and she's part of a team.
In 1996, Steve and Lisa Humphrey moved their family from their roots in Albany, Missouri, in the northwest part of the state, to Bates City, a rural area east of Kansas City, so that Taryn could train nearby. Since then, she's had almost no break from gymnastics. According to Caitlin White, Taryn's college teammate and roommate, Humphrey discovered a social life in Tuscaloosa.
We went from, you know, being elite gymnasts together, because, I mean, I've known her since 1999 and, like, on the national team and stuff, and we used to train seven and a half hours a day, so we had no time for a social life. And you come here and you train 3.5-4 hours, you know, at the most, and so we actually do get to experience a social life now, and I think she's really, really enjoying that.
Alabama has earned 4 NCAA championships and is one of the most successful women's gymnastics programs in the country. Before hosting the NCAA Central Regional last weekend, the average draw this season was 10,570 fans, the most in Southeastern Conference history and the second best in the nation over the last 10 years. According to Taryn Humphrey, the atmosphere at Coleman Coliseum makes her feel welcome.
I am so happy to be here on campus and settled down. I was sick of traveling by the time the tour was over, so it's nice to be in one spot, and the crowds are just great here. In Greece, it was totally different. Weren't very many people for U.S., but now it's just great to be able to compete and have people enjoy your gymnastics.
Despite all its success, Alabama has never had an Olympian join the team until Humphrey did this season. Her picture was featured on the cover of the Crimson Tide Gymnastics Media Guide, along with junior All-American Ashley Miles, another former member of the national team.
And the regional champions with a 196.675, the University of Alabama.
Humphrey, who didn't begin competing in all-around until February 25th, finished second in all-around at the regional to Miles, which pleased her coach, Sarah Patterson.
I was very happy for her. I don't have to say anything more than to look at her face in her floor exercise routine and to see that smile pop up. That was one of my goals this year, was for Taryn to have fun and enjoy gymnastics again. I watched 3 years ago as Ashley Miles went through the same thing.
The fourth-ranked Crimson Tide qualified as a team for the national meet for their 23rd consecutive season. As for Taryn Humphrey, she may never compete on the international level again. At the moment, she's not bothered by that prospect. Her focus is on the NCAA championship next week at Auburn, then enjoying as a fan Crimson Tide baseball and Tide football in the fall.
I thought in the end I would rather have a better education than go for gymnastics all my life. I won't be in that all my life, so you need a backup.
For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. For the third consecutive year, a team from Purdue University won the annual Rube Goldberg Machine Contest, a competition that encourages groups of engineering students to design absurdly complicated machines to do something exceptionally simple. The Purdue team built a device that needed 125 steps to change the batteries in a flashlight and then turn the flashlight on. Among the events that occurred in the process were the launch of a toy rocket, the simulation of a meteor striking the Earth, and the inevitable conflagration. Happily, the machine also doused the blaze and, of course, eventually loaded and turned on the flashlight. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the quest to knock George Washington Perry's behemoth bucket mouth out of the record books. But first, a Canadian priest reeled in a world record walleye last year, and he's using his catch to help devastated fishermen half a world away. Reporter Amy Jo Eamon brings us the story of the fishing father of Tobin Lake, Saskatchewan.
Mariusz Zajac believes in the power of prayer, hook, line, and sinker. He's a Roman Catholic priest who loves to fish. When he's not administering to his flock, he's casting lures at Tobin Lake in rural Saskatchewan.
I learned fishing when I was about 4 years old in Poland with my uncles. 2 years younger than my brother is a priest too in Poland. You know, we pray and we fish together. Usually we make the kind of deal. When we catch a fish, we'll sing that song. Uwielbiaj duszo moja sławę Pana mego, chwała Boga stworzyciela tak bardzo dobrego.
That song is the Canticle of Mary from the Gospel according to Luke, chapter 1, verses 46 to 55. It's about Mary, the mother of Jesus, and the namesake of Father Mariusz. He says that prayer of thanks every day near sundown. He said it one frigid Tuesday in early January while fishing from an ice shack on Tobin Lake.
It was quiet. There were other people fishing in other shacks, even some of my parishioners as well. They went by that well at that time, and I didn't catch anything.
He decided to drop his line one more time, say his prayer, and call it a day.
You know, I was jigging with a spoon, five diamond spoon, Len Thompson spoon, and with minnow on it. And I was jigging, and, you know, when I start praying that hymn of gratitude and praise, that moment, You know, I felt a little nimble. All of a sudden, you know, I recognized it was a walleye and it was a big one.
He proudly showed his catch to the others fishing nearby. They convinced him to have it weighed, just in case it was a record. The nearest digital scale was half an hour away at the grocery store in the town of Nipawin. And it was a whopper, 18.3 pounds, 36 and a half inches long, 22 and a half inches around. Within a few weeks, it was confirmed by the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame in Wisconsin. It was the largest walleye ever caught through the ice. Since that day, he's got a new nickname, Father Walleye.
Yeah, I like it. I really, it stick with me. So I'm not afraid to say that I'm proud of it. No, because it's meaningful, because all the apostles, most of the apostles, the fishermen, you know, to be fishermen of men, and Jesus is using that expression.
Sure. I'll go press and open the cabinet.
Father Mariusz proudly totes his prized fish, now stuffed and mounted, in a large plywood box. He takes it from town to town in his parish so the curious can see it. But today the walleye finds a permanent home in his cabin at Tobin Lake.
All right, open her up.
Yes.
I'm very excited.
Another fishing enthusiast has come to see for himself and snap a photograph of Father Walleye and his big fish.
Okay, I'm trying to get it all in the frame. It's too big.
Father Mariusz believes God gave him that fish for a reason, a feeling that was confirmed a few days later when he read a newspaper article about the fishermen devastated by the tsunami half a world away.
They said, you know, that we don't need any food, just who's going to help us buy boats and fishing equipment, and we can manage ourselves. So I felt in my heart, really, that, you know, if I would be able, you know, with the help of other fishermen, to buy one boat, really, my mission would be accomplished.
Using the internet, he contacted a priest in India. He learned that a fishing kit, including a 30-foot boat, three nets, and a 10-horsepower motor, costs $3,000. He set up an account at the credit union in his hometown of Carrot River, and has almost raised enough money for one full kit.
They set up the six families that would own that boat, and one within the six families would be one widow that would be sure that she gets the profit percentage of the money, that, you know, that is her living livelihood is assured.
The publicity has also been a boon to the resort village of Tobin Lake. On a warm spring day in early April, the snow is melting, but there's still 3 feet of ice on the lake as fishermen head out on their snowmobiles. News of the record walleye spread rapidly in fishing circles. The story was carried on radio and in newspapers across Canada and the Midwest. It also swept the internet, spawning false claims that the record walleye was pulled from a frozen lake in Minnesota and Ontario. But at Tobin Lake, they know the record is theirs. Vince Walser runs a lodge and marina on the lake.
I've had people from North Dakota here, people from Montana here this winter, which we've never had before, and maybe they can be the lucky one and catch a new world record. There is definitely another larger walleye than that in Tobin Lake, and it's going to be caught.
Oh yeah, that's gorgeous right there. You can even bring it this way a bit, to the left. Yeah, right there.
Until the record is broken, Father Walleye's record catch belongs here on his cabin wall, where it will serve as a reminder that sometimes fishing is more than fishing.
I wasn't praying for fish. It was just a part of my, you might say, routines or time that I designate, you know, for evening prayer. In that particular circumstances, you know, that was kind of a sign for me there is a, you know, something bigger than that.
It's going to be solid anyway.
Yeah. Will remain forever.
For Only a Game, I'm Amy Jo Eamon at Tobin Lake, Saskatchewan.
On a rainy June, Georgia day in 1932, a 20-year-old farmer named George Washington Perry decided it was too wet to plow, went fishing instead, and caught a largemouth bass that weighed 22 pounds, 4 ounces. Since then, fishermen from California to Florida and on down to Cuba have been trying to catch a bigger bass or to convince various authorities that they've already done so. That's the story at the center of Monty Burke's new book, Sow Belly, The Obsessive Quest for the World Record Largemouth Bass. Monty Burke joins me now from Alabama Public Radio in Montgomery. Monty, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
First of all, fishing being fishing, how sure is anybody that George Washington Perry actually caught a 22-pound, 4-ounce bass?
Well, it's interesting. People really aren't sure, and that kind of adds to the whole mystique and mystery of this record. He caught it back, as you said, back in 1932. He weighed the fish, sent the weight and the measurements into a Field and Stream big fish contest, and then he took it home and ate it. He fed it to his family for 2 nights. There was no picture. There was no mount of the fish. So by today's sort of exacting standards, his fish would have never passed muster.
The first challenger you chronicle is Bob Kruppe, and it might be an understatement to say that he fishes obsessively. You write of Mr. Kruppe that, quote, he doesn't know his children at all, doesn't know what their favorite foods are, what TV shows they watch, if they are happy and well-adjusted. Was this a discouraging condition to discover?
It, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, it was something I discovered in all of these characters. Bob, I mean, he used to work the late shift. He's an LAPD motorcycle cop. He's as big as a bear and about as nice as a bear. And he would work the night shift, come home for maybe 10 minutes, pick up his fishing gear, just take a peek to make sure his wife was still in there, usually bypass the kids' room, jump into his truck, pull his bass boat up to the state park there at Lake Castaic outside of Los Angeles. And he was always the first one there. And then he would fish for 12 hours a day.
Well, Bob Kruppe doesn't appear to get very much joy from the chase. In fact, he strikes me as a singularly miserable man. At one point, he says to you, quote, I'm done with the whole effing thing. And then he goes out fishing.
I know.
Was he unable to quit?
In the early 90s, Bob Kruppe was on the bite, so to speak, and closer to breaking this world record than anyone had ever come. I mean, he'd studied this lake. The lake was ripening, was just getting ready to bear fruit, was popping out huge bass. And he, you know, figured out where the big bass was, hooked it, brought it in, thought for sure this was the record. Takes it into the Fish and Game guys, and it turns out it's 4 ounces short. So here's this lifelong quest, and he comes up, you know, 4 ounces short. And I think he was perhaps a bitter man to begin with, and I think this perhaps made him even more so.
One of the more intriguing characters you discovered is Mickey Ellis, who makes lures for the guys who chase the bass record. Mickey Ellis told you that God asked him to make lures. Tell me about that.
As with a lot of pursuits, I think, that become subcultures, there are cottage industries that are sort of grow up around it. Mickey was one of the more intriguing characters I ran across. He was, you could say, I guess, an ex-con. After jail, he worked on motorcycles. He raced motorcycles. He was just kind of your typical hellraiser. And then one day he did find God, and he swears that one day he was out on the water and he asked God to tell him what he should do with his life, and that God told him that he should make lures, and that he should make in particular lures that would help someone catch and break the world record for the largemouth bass. And he makes these absolutely beautiful, they're very lifelike. Bass out in California eat rainbow trout. So he makes these beautiful rainbow trout that look like if you took it to Connecticut, for instance, you could probably sell it at a flea market.
Many of the stories you encountered ran toward the bizarre. For example, you discovered more than one person determined to grow the biggest largemouth bass. Tell me how some of those folks have proceeded.
Well, it's interesting. I found not only a person, I found a state. And I bet you can guess which state is has the sort of hubris to try this. And, of course, it's the state of Texas.
It has to be Texas.
They have a whole center called the Texas Freshwater Fisheries Center, which is in Athens, Texas. They originally said, oh, we're just going to grow bigger bass so that the bass fishing in Texas is better for all. But really behind the scenes, there were these sort of two mad scientists, mad biologists, I should say, who really had designs on growing the world record bass. And then, of course, there's an individual named Porter Hall, who's actually originally from Alabama. Porter is, as I describe him in the book, sort of the Forrest Gump of the world record bass chase. Ever since he was 10 years old, he's wanted to break this world record. So what he did, he has such a keen sense of the history of the world record, he bought property in Mississippi on the same latitude of Telfair County, which is the county from which the original world record came from. He's constructed two ponds on that property, and in those two ponds, he's trying to grow the world record bass.
You talk about one couple that brought in an enormous bass to be, I don't know, they don't call it stuffed, really. They make a mold and recreate the shape of the fish. And when they cut open the fish, they were astonished to find 4 pounds of lead in the fish's belly.
That's right. She actually, Sandy DeFresco is her name, and she actually achieved quite a bit of fame for catching this enormous fish out in California. But it turned out as when they brought the fish down to the taxidermist, of course, offered to do it for free. And when he ripped open the belly there, a 4-pound diving weight fell out. And the guy apparently just stood there and looked at it for a second, and then he turned to the DeFrescos and said, "Please get out of my store." Her fish, by the way, is even without the weight, was 19 pounds, and she's still in the top 20. Her fish is still listed in the top 25 of the biggest bass ever caught.
And how the diving weight got there was never established precisely.
It never was. There were lots of different rumors. One rumor was that they caught it at night, which they weren't supposed to be fishing at night, so they left it hooked up to a boat so that they could, quote unquote, catch it again in the morning, and they tied a diving weight to the fish to keep it underwater, and that somehow the fish swallowed it overnight.
You mentioned polygraphs at several points in your book. What are some of the other ways in which fishermen can be dissuaded from cheating or by which cheaters can be caught?
You know, it's a very hard thing to police. I mean, it's not like the single season home run record in baseball. I mean, we all read about Barry Bonds' record. Those who wanted to watch it could watch it on television over and over again on ESPN. Fishing by its very nature, and especially these world record chasers, it's a very solitary endeavor. There are certain things you're supposed to do. You know, you're supposed to send in the line that you use to bring in the fish. You're supposed to have a photograph. You're supposed to have an eyewitness. And it leaves open a lot of space to cheat. And that's why I think so many people have tried to do it. They instituted after 2003, there was a false claim, and the IGFA decided to institute for the world record bass the option to use a polygraph test if they so desired.
Why do you suppose that fishing, which is supposed to be relaxing and contemplative, at least for the fishermen, has become so competitive?
A lot of it has to do with just the bass itself. Largemouth bass are found in every state in the Union except for Alaska. And then in every one of the outdoor magazines, there is a story. It's a perennial favorite, the story of George Perry's world record fish. And I think that it has the elements of a great story that is retold and sort of mythologized, so to speak, because there was no proof of his fish, and he was a dirt poor farmer, and it was at the absolute depth of the Depression in the 1930s. So it sort of has this sort of frontier myth thing going for it. And also it has to do a little bit with the longevity of the record, I think. I mean, it's not too much of a stretch, I think, to compare this to the Red Sox World Series futility, the 86 years. I mean, for 73 years, people have been trying to break this world record. And we have all this great new technology. We've got graphite rods. We've got incredible lines. We've got all these brand new lures. We have fish finders. We have motors on our boats. And we still can't break this record. So I think that sort of adds to the power of it.
At the end of Sow Belly, you write that the record really could be broken at any time by anybody. A kid with a bamboo pole could happen. I'm wondering if folks have been writing you since the publication of the book to tell you, hey, I already caught the bass that weighs 23, 25, 28 pounds, maybe even more.
I like to think, too, that maybe there was someone, and it is true. I mean, I think that's something that as I talk to all these guys and profile these guys and spend so much time with them, the single thing that drove them the craziest was the fact that even though these guys were arguably the best bass fishermen in the world and arguably some of the best fishermen in the world, I mean, they're hunting the oldest and the wiliest and the biggest fish in the lake, that it is so random. I mean, you and I will never break the single season home run record. That's for sure. I know I won't. You might. but any one of us, you know, an 8-year-old boy or girl on his or her first fishing trip could break this world record. And I think that sort of randomness drives these guys absolutely crazy.
Monty Burke, who writes for Forbes magazine, is the author of Sow Belly, The Obsessive Quest for the World Record Largemouth Bass, published by Dutton. Monty, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
Get out your little boat, fill it up with gas. Drive it to the setback or hot beach fast. Find your favorite lure, throw it in the grass. Hold your breath and wait for floating bass.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
Exploding bass, exploding bass. Nothing make your heart beat quite so fast. More like regret yet your eyes will pass.
When you hook a big exploding
bass, but the crazy is you pull her in. Jump out of water, shake her fin. Grab her by the lip, hold on very tight. Exploding bass always give a great big fight. Hold her up to look, but treat her good. Exploding bass not going to be your food. Take a picture, maybe see how much she
It's wins. 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, CabotCheese.com, and by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Scrabble Punks Unite Against Bad Hats. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
And I'm a double word score.
That's excellent. Good to hear. Several teams managed to qualify for the NBA playoffs this week. It is safe to say, perhaps, that Washington is one of the more surprising or least quiet qualifiers?
Washington is a surprising qualifier, but to me, the most surprising qualifier has been the storm of noise that are the Denver Nuggets, who were dead in the water prior to hiring George Karl and have stormed past everybody, lost less than a handful of games since the All-Star break. That's a remarkable, remarkable turnaround in a very tough division and a very tough conference. And as far as the Eastern Conference goes, you have to look at Miami struggling a little bit down the stretch. Shaquille O'Neal's been out a little bit, and that's a lot more interesting than it looked to be a month ago.
You mentioned the Chicago Bulls. They are on the board, I believe, as the only a game staff sleeper pick for the NBA playoffs. But Eddie Curry is now sidelined for the season with a heart ailment. What Eastern Conference teams can challenge the Pistons and the Heat?
Probably none of them. Indiana has not turned around quite that much. Chicago will miss Eddie Curry. He was developing into a fine, old-style, back-to-the-basket, button-your-gut center. It's Miami or Detroit's to lose. I don't think the Celtics can give either of those teams a challenge over seven games.
And in the West, do we have time to discuss all the teams that might win?
I don't believe in Seattle. I think they're a soft 50-28. I think they're the third seed, and I think they're going to go out pretty quickly. I've got to stay with San Antonio. They just seem to play more soundly than Phoenix does. But if that does come down to being the Western Conference final series, that will be worth buying a ticket for because it will be a lot of fun.
NBA Commissioner David Stern has announced that he wants to prevent players who are under 20 from entering the NBA. And Jermaine O'Neal of the Indiana Pacers opined this week that racism might have something to do with Mr. Stern's plan. A valid charge?
I think it's part of the stew of why this is a bad idea. I think his other points about age limits, namely that you don't hear about it in baseball and hockey, but most pointedly, if you can go into the Army at 18 and go fight a war, you ought to be able to fly to Chicago in February and play against the Bulls.
The venerable Lord Stanley is due to make a court appearance perhaps as early as May.
He's very old,
That issue is whether the NHL has the right to shelve the cup until the league figures out how to resume business, or whether somebody else has the right to play for the Stanley Cup this year. Would you care to predict the outcome of this court challenge?
Well, let's first of all establish right away that if Calgary had managed to beat Tampa last year for the last time the NHL teams played for the Stanley Cup, we wouldn't be having this discussion at all. This is a bunch of grumpy Canadians with the bends who can't face the fact that the Stanley Cup is likely going to be in Florida for another year because the people to whom they've handed the sport they are so dedicated to have managed to hand it over to the Marx Brothers. So basically what you've got is a bunch of Canadian amateur hockey players who claim that Lord Stanley in his bequest never mentioned the National Hockey League. Well, you know what? He never mentioned trucks or airplanes either, so are they going to carry it on foot back from Florida?
The remarkable chip shot that helped Tiger Woods win his fourth Masters jacket last Sunday, the one where the ball kind of hesitated on the rim before it fell in, will pay serious dividends for Nike as well.
Never let it be said that the microchip that they insert into the base of your brain when you go to work for Nike ever sleeps. The marketing directors put together a campaign because, among other things, the ball that went in the cup for Tiger to help him win the Masters is called the One Platinum, and it isn't going to hit the market till next month. And you can buy a dozen of them for $54.
Yeah, I lose golf balls a lot. I buy a dozen for about $1.80.
Yes, I can buy a dozen of the golf balls I use for about 89 cents, and that depends on how many of them I find in the woods because I'm going to be there anyway.
Meanwhile, Terrell Owens claimed this week that his demand to renegotiate his 7-year, $49 million contract, the contract he signed with the Eagles last year, has nothing to do with greed or selfishness. What does it have to do with?
Money!
Oh.
Money is morally neutral. It's people who are greedy and selfish. Why are they greedy and selfish? Because they want more money!
Tuesday's soccer match between AC Milan and Inter Milan ended prematurely when the AC Milan goalkeeper was hit by a flare thrown by somebody in the stands. Happily, Dida, the keeper, was not seriously injured. I guess we should be glad throwing flares is one tradition that hasn't made it to U.S. venues
yet. It's because there were more flares that were thrown out after they hit the goalkeeper with it. What do they possibly screen these people for when they go into the stadium?
My question exactly. You know, I don't get that one. The next night...
Oh, boy!
When Liverpool faced Juventus in a Champions League game in Turin, fans of both teams threw plastic bottles, seats, and various other things at each other. Wouldn't it be great if we could just talk about which teams won?
Well, let's not forget that 150 other supporters had batons and faced off against police officers and pelting them with various missiles, including flares.
Yes.
Two cars were in flames. One of them is a police car. And, Bill, that's why they call it the beautiful game.
Absolutely. Ron Artest was the first thing that came to my mind. Those were the words of Yankee outfielder Gary Sheffield after he tussled briefly with a Red Sox fan at Fenway Park on Thursday night. Was Sheffield afraid that David Stern would suspend him for the season?
I don't know what's going on here. Some idiot in the right field stands reaches down and pops a player while he's trying to field the ball. The player, you know, makes nasty at him, and now suddenly we're into another chaotic thing. You know what? I think it would be really neat if the Red Sox and the Yankees didn't play each other for a while because, frankly, their fans are turning into idiots.
Charlie, I don't know if in your visits to various press boxes and clubhouses you have ever run into a fellow named Mark Sabia. Apparently, he has been impersonating a sports writer for almost 20 years. And boy, if you're going to pretend to be something you're not, that's aiming awfully low.
You've got to love cold cuts. I mean, you really got to love cold cuts and old pasta to do this. Although, masquerading as a sports writer, I could get in a lot of trouble misusing that phrase, so yeah, I think I'll just let it pass for the moment.
Moving right along.
Yes, thank you very much.
And finally, Charlie, in case you have ever wondered which athletes are the most venerated in China, a partial answer apparently is jumping, running, and swimming pigs.
Oh, you look at your life, Bill, you look at your life in the arc of it, and you realize that sometimes the fish is really big and the barrel is really small. So let's continue. In the actual Olympics, the pigs don't compete. They merely organize them.
Charlie Pierce, whose pen wiggles for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
I want you to remember today is supposed to be fun, okay? It's supposed to be fun. Everybody wants to win, but not everybody's going to win all the time.
That Saturday's National School Scrabble Championship in Boston should have begun with an injunction to have fun might seem unnecessary. Scrabble is a game. Games are supposed to be fun. But there was seriousness of purpose evident at this competition, even before play began. Shortly after, he'd reminded the hotel function room full of 5th to 8th graders that the point of the day was fun. John Williams, the executive director of the National Scrabble Association, provided the 200 assembled youngsters with a glimpse of what their futures might hold with a couple of introductions.
One is former world and national Scrabble champion, Joel Sherman, G.I. Joel. And current national Scrabble champion, whom you may have seen on ESPN last year, Trey Wright. Right. Somebody in this room is going to take their place someday. Not for a while, because they're still playing great, but just remember that. So keep an eye on them.
On Saturday, the competitors had more immediate concerns. Ryan Porter, the coach of a team from Evangelical Christian School in Memphis, Tennessee, explained.
The winning team splits up $5,000, so it's a pretty big carrot for an eighth grader. I know I never played for anything close to that. So there can be some nerves, but just got to relax and just treat it like any other game.
Did you get this both ways?
Yeah.
Six, 12.
13, 14.
Scrabble played to pass a winter evening is a simple matter. You pick some lettered tiles out of a bag, arrange them on a rack, and try to make words, piling up points as you employ little-used letters and cover double and triple word score boxes on the board. If you think your opponent has made up a word, you grab the dictionary and check. At the National School Scrabble Tourney, the process was a little more formal. Challenges were resolved when judges wearing black and white striped referees' jerseys were summoned to the dispute.
Okay. Here's the challenge slip.
Okay, words challenged.
E-X.
Where is it on the board, please?
E-X.
Okay. The play is good. Acceptable.
The players who'd come from Tennessee with Coach Ryan Porter were all dressed in red T-shirts featuring the legend Sola Deo Gloria. At Coach Porter's suggestion, some of his players were wearing strange hats. Beyond that, the coach has tried to teach his students how to draw opponents into a challenge they will lose.
There's kind of an aspect of poker to the game and your body language and how you play something. If you know it's a word and you'd like to induce a challenge, maybe it's obscure, you're going to maybe play it,
take a deep
kind
breath
of just like, maybe look like, I don't know if I should do this. You play it, you hesitantly play the play, hit your clock.
Rubbing your brows,
going, please don't challenge, but you want them to.
Sola Deo Gloria doesn't preclude bluffing.
There's bluffing. I said, you know, while some people would consider that bad, I said, this is just part of the game, you know. You're not telling them anything, it's just body language.
After each timed game ended, the 100 teams of two players each traded places. Bags of tiles were shaken, good luck hats were readjusted, and once again it was game on.
Okay, team 67.
67.
Yeah, score 320.
320.
Yeah, team 43.
43.
Score 254.
As scores were tallied, it began to become apparent that some of the pairs from Ryan Porter's evangelical school team might be in contention for a considerable cash prize. This may or may not have delighted Coach Porter, who'd earlier acknowledged that there could be a certain nasty disappointment associated with coming close.
This is my third one to come to, and I don't know. It's just been so close, and just having to console people after they know and they just lost, you know, a chance to be the champs and win 5,000. Had to do that twice. I really don't want to have to do it again. I'd almost rather lose earlier than have that happen again.
After three rounds of games, the 100 teams broke for lunch. As they were leaving the hall, Sam, a seventh grader at the Bayshore Middle School on Long Island, and her teammates discussed the extent to which their opponents' creative psychs, the hats, the T-shirts, and so on, had worked.
There were games last night, word games, and their kids who have like six ribbons. That means they won all the word games. So that's a little intimidating. Like you say, oh, wow, these kids must be good. But the hats, that doesn't really show any skill. I think that's just...
The only thing about the hats, now we really want to play those people and beat them because we don't like their hats.
Down the hall, most of the kids joined their parents and coaches to re-energize themselves at a buffet of French fries, burgers, pasta, and fried zucchini. Comfortably sporting a 3-games-1-none-lost record at the break, Katie Devaney, who'd come to town a day earlier from Philadelphia, described the way Scrabble had first captured her interest.
I was 11 when I went to club for the first time, and it was like there was an article in the paper about it, and I had started to get like good. I was able to beat my parents sometimes, so they took me to club, and then at club I started going to tournaments and stuff.
And any game in which you find you can beat your parents, that's bound to be something that is a big draw, right?
Oh, yes. Especially since my mom was always like telling me how good a Scrabble player she was, it's like, oh yeah.
Across the room, several players sat hunched over their ketchup-smeared plates. Anna Mitchell, a sixth grader, wore dark glasses and a black T-shirt bearing the letters WIB, which I learned stood for Women in Black. Beside Anna sat her mom, similarly attired. Anna's teammate, Alex Hodson, and her mom wore the uniform as well. I asked Anna Mitchell about the dark glasses.
Because, like, then you don't have a... glint in your eyes if you get a really good tile and stuff, because if you wear glasses, it's like I once was flipping the channels through TV and I heard that this one player was wearing glasses because people could tell in your eyes if you have something good
or not. Somehow his eyes would reveal a wonderful tile had appeared, yeah. And so is it working, or how you doing?
We lost two games, but that's because the first game, I think, was sixth graders we played, and we won that. The next game was seventh graders, so it's a lot harder.
This result suggested that, in one respect at least, Scrabble doesn't differ much from football, basketball, or baseball. Advantage big kids. On the other hand, in Scrabble, the nature of the advantage, as Anna Mitchell explained, differs considerably.
There's this one word, aliquot, A-L-I-Q-U-O-T, that actually my mom taught me, but my dentist knew it too, which is strange because she played Scrabble. It's something to do with science, and a lot of older people know that because they study physics more instead of, like, your bones and stuff, which is more 6th to 5th grade type of thing.
That Woman in Black's rationalization aside, numbers of the youngsters at the National School Scrabble Tourney had already played in adult tournaments, and according to Scrabble Association Executive Director John Williams, some of them had done rather well.
I've lost to at least one of these kids, and almost lost to a couple of others. Yeah, they're.
And yet you maintain your dignity somehow here. As
I
we
do.
Speak.
Well, I. It's a daily challenge, but I do. So far today, it's hanging in there, but we'll see.
When the last points were totaled at the end of Saturday's Scrabble action, Coach Ryan Porter might have been forgiven if he'd sighed, "Alas, it has happened again." The Sola Deo Gloria bunch made it to the championship table, but fifth was the best any of their pairs could manage. Consolation was once again the order of the day. Katie Devaney, whose inspiration came in part from beating her mom at the Scrabble board, led her team to second place, which was worth $2,000. At lunch, I'd asked Katie what she planned to do with any money she might win.
Well, I like to win it first, but if I get to win it, I'll probably buy a computer or something and hockey stuff. So.
Hockey stuff. That makes me feel very good because I came here kind of with the idea that people who are this good at Scrabble maybe didn't do too much of anything else, but you got hockey on your mind.
Yes, and I'm very upset that they canceled the NHL season. Oh, well.
Kind of puts Saturday's competition in perspective, doesn't it? No, not the mention of the lost hockey season. The giggles. Giggles. Let's see, that would be 3 G's, 2, 4, 6, and 4 more. 10 points for the letters and 50 extra points for using all my tiles. Ha! A bingo, cool.
This is the end of the round. Please stop the clock and work on the table.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Alabama Public Radio's Butler Kane. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to scan Scrabble photos, browse Only a Game's show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Sow Belly author Monty Burke, who puts George Washington Perry's record 22-pound, 4-ounce largemouth bass into national perspective.
The average bass caught by the 44 million freshwater fishermen in the United States is 2 pounds.
I also hear the average bass has spawned 2.3 small fry, owns a dogfish, and drives a Toyota Camry. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.